This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We have a very interesting discussion ahead about the evolution of the roles of women in the U.S. military since the founding of the United States. Two military veterans, Jerry Bell, who served in the Navy, and Tracy Crowe, a former Marine, have put together an illuminating anthology of women's writings about their experiences in war. Titled It's My Country Too, the book presents excerpts from diaries, letters, oral histories, pension depositions, and published and unpublished memoirs, all documenting the courage, resourcefulness, and resilience with which women have served in the armed forces. Women have been struggling to fight alongside men since the beginning of our country, really. Back during the revolutionary period, women would sometimes follow their husbands into war out of necessity. Many could be found in military camps, working as laundresses, cooks, and nurses. In the Civil War, some functioned as spies, and several hundred women disguised as men served as soldiers in either the Union or the Confederate side. In World War I, women were allowed to join the military in limited roles, and those roles expanded some during World War II, although they still did not include combat duty. Not until 1976 were the first women admitted to the military service academies, and another 15 years passed before Congress in 1991 authorized women to fly in combat missions, and then 2 years later said women could serve on combat ships. In more recent years, the number of jobs available to women has expanded rapidly, with the Pentagon finally opening all ground combat positions to women at the start of last year. So clearly, it's taken women a long time to earn a permanent place in the American military and gain full access to assignments. Now, Jerry herself retired from the Navy nearly a decade ago after assignments that ranged from anti-submarine warfare in the Azores Islands to attaché duty at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. She's now managing editor of O Dark 30, which is the literary journal of the Veterans Writing Project. Tracy joined the Marines out of high school in the late 1970s and served for 10 years. That included stints as a public affairs officer and military journalist. She has a master's degree in creative writing and has taught the subject and has written a handful of previous books. One is a memoir, Eyes Write, and another is a guide to military writing titled On Point. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jerry Bell and Tracy Crowe.
I'm going to turn this whole thing over to you. No.
Nice try.
Okay. What you need to know before we really share too much about this is that this book would not have been possible, not one word of it, had it not been for my partner over here, Jerry Bell. Jerry and I have known each other, according to Facebook yesterday, 3 whole years. And I guess it was about 2 years ago, after a year of maybe stalking each other on Facebook, we knew a lot of the same friends. We were reading a lot of the same books by people we knew. And one day, I got either a Facebook message or an email from you that said, hey, if you're coming to D.C. anytime soon, I'd like to sit down with you and talk to you about a book idea I have. Well, what Jerry did not know was that I had no intention, after having already put together 4 military books, of working on another military book. And so, as it so happened, my husband was actually a coach for the Washington Nationals 2 years ago. And so I had to be in D.C. So I contacted Jerry and said, okay, we'll go ahead and meet for lunch and let me see what I can do to help you with your book idea. But I took another friend, CJ, also former Marine with me. We've known each other for 36 years. And we're both in public affairs together out at Camp Pendleton when we were a lot younger. And I said, CJ, your task is to make sure that I do not say yes to Jerry Bell. Whatever you do, kick me under the table, kick my shins, whatever. Don't let me say yes to Jerry Bell. So there we were, a sailor and two Marines walking into a bar.
Two Marines are no match for a sailor who is determined. And I had chosen Tracy as a potential co-author pretty carefully, first because of her memoir, Eyes Right, which I loved, and it told me that she understood something about both the risks and the rewards of writing a women's military story. Second, because she had edited an anthology of military essays, Red, White, and True. And thirdly, because writing a book I thought might be really, really hard, and I might want to quit, and I might need a kick in the butt. And there's just nobody who kicks sailors in the butt better than a U.S. Marine. And I figured that Tracy was probably a sucker for a good story. So that was kind of how I reeled her in, by reading her, by telling her a good story. And one of the ones I told her was the story of the first woman to take a leadership role in a raid into enemy territory. And that person, kind of surprised her to find out, was Harriet Tubman. In 1863, Harriet Tubman had gone down to South Carolina and was working in relief efforts for freed slaves, supporting herself by selling gingerbread and root beer and making homemade medicine. But she also created a spy network of former slaves who told her that there were what they called torpedoes, but they were naval mines up the Combahee River. And so eventually a colonel who had some expertise in guerrilla warfare took two gunboats and went up the Combahee River with Harriet Tubman, with a regiment of segregated African-American soldiers, and they conducted a raid on plantations, on a bridge, and on railroad. Tubman was illiterate, but she was a fantastic storyteller, and she gave an interview to two journalists about 30 years apart, and they were very, very similar, almost verbatim in some places. And so we were able to lay hands on that manuscript, which is up at a small museum in Cayuga, New York. And I'd like to share Harriet Tubman's story of the Combahee River Raid in her own words. It's page 27, if anybody wants to read along. They gave us Colonel Montgomery, one of John Brown's men, to command the expedition, and three gunboats and all colored soldiers, and we found where the torpedoes was and saw that we could find another channel. When we went up the river in the morning, 'twas just about light, the fog was rising over the rice fields, and the people was just doing their breakfast and was going out to the field. I was in the forward boat where the colonel and captain and the colored man that was to tell us where the torpedoes was. The boats was a quarter of a mile apart, one after the other, and just about light, the colonel blowed the whistle and stopped the boat, and the captain and a company of soldiers went ashore. About a quarter of an hour after he done blowed the whistle, and when the sun got clear so that the people could see the boats, you could look over the rice fields and see them coming to the boat from every direction. I never seen such a sight. Some was getting their breakfasts, just taking their pots of rice right off the fire, and they'd put a cloth on top of their head and set that on, rice a-smoking, young one hanging on behind, one hand around the mother's forehead to hold on, t'other hand digging into the rice pot, eating with all its might. Some had white blankets on their heads with their things done up in them, and them that hadn't a pot of rice would have a child in their arms, sometimes one or two holding on to the mother's dress, some carrying two children, one astride of the mother's neck, holding on to her forehead, and in her arms. Appears like I never seen so many twins in my life. Some had bags on their backs. with pigs in them. Some had chickens tied by the legs. And so child squalling, chickens squawking, and pigs squealing, they all come running to the gunboats through the rice fields just like a procession. Thinks I, these here puts me in mind of the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. When they got to the shore, they'd get in the rowboat and they'd start for the gunboat, but others would run and hold on so they couldn't leave the shore. They wasn't coming and they ain't nobody else come. The soldiers beat them on the hands, but they wouldn't let go. They was afraid the gunboats would go off and leave them. At last, the captain looked at him and he called me. They called me Moses Garrison down there. Said he, Moses, come here and speak to your people. Well, they wasn't my people any more than they was his'n, only we was all Negroes, because I didn't know any more about them than he did. So I went when he called me on the gunboat and they the shore. They didn't know anything about me, and I didn't know what to say. I looked at him for about 2 minutes, and then I sung to him. Come from the east, come from the west, among all the glorious nations, this glorious one's the best. Come along, don't be alarmed, for Uncle Sam is rich enough to give you all a farm. Then they throwed up their hands and began to rejoice and shout glory, and the rowboats would push off. I kept on a singing until all were brought on board. We got 800 people that day, and we tore up the railroad and fired the bridge. And we went up to a big house and catched two pigs and named the white pig Beauregard and the black pig Jeff Davis. When we got back to Hilton Head in the morning and landed their 900 contrabands, I took 100 of the men to the recruiting officer and they enlisted in the Army. Colonel Whittle said I ought to be paid for every soldier as much as a recruiting officer, but laws, I never got nothing.
So there we were at the bar that day at lunch. Actually, it was really Gordon Biersch over there near Nationals Park. And Jerry is telling me this story about Harriet Tubman. And then she's telling me another story and another story. And I'm so enthralled listening to all of these because what she had done was already an entire year's worth of research before she even invited me to lunch to talk about this book idea. So she had already been researching all these archives and oral histories and everything. So I was thinking, Jerry, where are we getting all this information? How are we going to build this book? Or how are you going to build this book at this point? And she said, well, it's really important that we allow the women to tell their own stories. And I heard that, and it was like a little bell went off. Ding! And she said, they need to be able to tell their own stories in their own words. So I want to look at the archives. I want to find diaries and journals and published memoirs, unpublished memoirs, oral histories, newspaper interviews, congressional testimonies, depositions, all of this. And I kept waiting for the kick from CJ, and it never came. And I think she would probably tell you that she was just as excited as I was. Because as Jerry talked, I was at the stage of, well, you don't really need me. I'll just help in any way that I possibly can. This is your idea. You've already worked on this and researched this a whole year. You don't need me. I mean, I'll just try to open a door, and inside I'm going, pick me, pick me. You need me. You need me on this book. She really didn't need me on this book. She says she did, but
Tracy only thinks that I had done a lot of research. I thought I had, and so one of the first things I did was I called the curator over at the Women in Military Service for America Memorial. And when Tracy says there are people we couldn't have written the book without, it's the staff at the Women's Memorial. We called Britta Granrod. We said, Britta, we've got about 30 books that we need to come over and read. And when we showed up that morning, there were almost 200 books on the table, and Britta said, you need to know all these stories, too. So So it was far from my research. The book would not have happened without the Women's Memorial. If there are military women in this audience today and you haven't registered, just go get it done.
So story after story, she shared with me what she had already uncovered. And as I said, my heart was leaping and I was thinking, I've got to be part of this. I want to be part of this. Pick me, pick me. Yeah, you need me, you need me. And fortunately, she really did think for some reason that she needed me on this. And so I was fortunate enough to play some small role in it. But this book would not have been possible without her idea, her conviction, and just devotion and dedication mostly to this idea that for so long, women's stories, women's military stories have just been discounted or appropriated by others. And so she just felt like the timing was right. It is time to give these women a voice. And that really got my attention. As a former journalist, and at the time, a journalism professor, that's what I was teaching my students. The beauty of journalism is giving a voice to the voiceless. And so that's, in a sense, what I think we both feel as if we've been able to do with this book. One story in particular that really captured me that day was the story of a young woman named Cornelia Fort. Does that name ring a bell with anyone? Cornelia Fort? If you've seen one of the many Pearl Harbor movies, possibly you've seen one version that has a young woman flying a plane by herself when she comes across an entire squadron of Japanese planes. Have you seen that version? Does that ring a bell? That woman was Cornelia Fort. She was one of the first people to actually spot the Japanese flying toward Pearl Harbor. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to share a little bit of an excerpt that was published in Women's Home Companion. Are you ready? Okay. Give me a minute. I'm not quite as coordinated as Jerry over here. Let me see. Let's go to page 122 for those of you who are following along. And I'm going to just read a little bit of her bio first. So Cornelia Fort was born in 1919, and she died in 1943. And she was part of the U.S. Women's Auxiliary Flying Squadron. On the morning of December 7th, 1941, civilian instructor pilot Cornelia Fort was airborne with a student pilot in an Interstate Cadet monoplane over Pearl Harbor. She saw a military aircraft flying directly at her. She took the controls and pulled up over the oncoming plane. Only then did she see the rising sun emblem on its wings. Moments later, she realized that Pearl Harbor was under attack. Japanese Zeros strafed her plane, but she landed and ran to safety with her student pilot. In 1942, Nancy Harkness Love invited Fort, then just 23, to join the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron, later merged with the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. So here's a little excerpt titled "At the Twilight's Last Gleaming." I knew I was going to join the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron before the organization was a reality, before it had a name, before it was anything but a radical idea in the minds of a few men who believed that women could fly airplanes. But I never knew it so surely as I did in Honolulu on December 7, 1941. At dawn that morning, I drove from Waikiki to the John Rogers Civilian Airport right next to Pearl Harbor, where I was a pilot instructor. Shortly after 6:30, I began landing and takeoff practice with my regular student. Coming in just before the last landing, I looked casually around and saw a military plane come directly toward me. I jerked the controls away from my student and jammed the throttle wide open to pull above the oncoming plane. He passed so close under us that our celluloid windows rattled violently, and I looked down to see what kind of plane it was. The painted red balls on the tops of the wings shone brightly in the sun. I looked again with complete and utter disbelief. Honolulu was familiar with the emblem of the rising sun on passenger ships, but not on airplanes. I looked quickly at Pearl Harbor, and my spine tingled when I saw billowing black smoke. Still, I thought hollowly, it might be some kind of coincidence or maneuvers it might be. It must be. for surely, dear God. Then I looked way up and saw the formations of silver bombers riding in. Something detached itself from an airplane and came glistening down. My eyes followed it down, and even with knowledge pounding in my mind, my heart turned convulsively when the bomb exploded in the middle of the harbor. I knew the air was not the place for my little baby airplane, and I set about landing as quickly as ever I could. A few seconds later, a shadow passed over me, and simultaneously, bullets splattered all around me. Suddenly, that little wedge of sky above Hickam Field and Pearl Harbor was the busiest, fullest piece of sky I ever saw. I'll skip you forward a little bit. Because there were so many disbelievers in women pilots, especially their place in the Army, officials wanted the best possible qualifications to go with the first experimental group. All of us realized what a spot we were on. We had to deliver the goods or else there wouldn't ever be another chance for women pilots in any part of the service. We have hopes of replacing men pilots, but we can each release a man to combat, to faster ships, to overseas work. Delivering a trainer to Texas may be as important as delivering a bomber to Africa if you take the long view. We are beginning to prove that women can be trusted to deliver airplanes safely and in the doing serve the country, which is our country too. I have yet to have a feeling which approaches any satisfaction, that of having signed, sealed, and delivered an airplane for the United States Army. The attitude that most non-flyers have about pilots is distressing and often acutely embarrassing. They chatter about the glamour of flying. Well, any pilot can tell you how glamorous it is. We get up in the cold dark in order to get to the airport by daylight. We wear heavy, cumbersome flying clothes and a 30-pound parachute. You are either cold or hot. If you are a female, your lipstick wears off and your hair gets straighter and straighter. You look forward all afternoon to the bath you will have and the steak. Well, we get the bath, but seldom the steak. Sometimes we are too tired to eat and fall wearily into bed. None of us can put into words why we fly. It is something different for each of us. I can't say exactly why I fly, but I know why, as I've never known anything in my life. I, for one, am profoundly grateful that my one talent, my only knowledge, flying, happens to be of use to my country when it is needed. That's all the luck I ever hoped to have. Isn't that lovely? What really got to me about Cornelia Fort's story is that this was published posthumously. And I'll share with you why. On March 21st, 1943, Cornelia led a flight of six new male graduates on a 90-day flight training program, ferrying BT-13 trainers to Dallas. Although ferry pilots were forbidden to fly in close formation, pilot Frank Stamos began flying close to Fort's plane and then pulling up. On one pass, his landing gear collided with the tip of Cornelia Fort's left wing. The wing tip broke away with 6 feet of leading edge attached. Fort's plane went into a vertical dive and impacted the ground nose down. When Fort became the first woman pilot to die on active duty, she was one of the most accomplished women pilots in the United States. She had logged 1,100 hours. Stamos, only 267. So this article was published posthumously for Women's Home Companion in June 1943.
Tracy and I initially went into the project thinking that for each of the wars, we needed just a little bit of historical context about women's status in the armed forces. And what we started finding when we started actually doing the research through some of the scholarly volumes, and there are some very good ones, is that we didn't know our own military story despite 30 years in the armed forces. We had been told from the time that we were in accession training that women only served in support and administrative roles, that women were allowed to join the armed forces. I object to the word allowed. We were not allowed. We took what we wanted. And an example of that is Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a trained physician and surgeon who at the beginning of the Civil War went to Washington, D.C. and demanded a spot with the Army as an Army contract surgeon. She was turned away. She didn't care. She went on to the Indiana Hospital in Washington, D.C. and made herself one of the two surgeons treating the wounded. She went out to the Battle of Fredericksburg to help evacuate wounded there. And then she went down to Chickamauga again as a volunteer and so impressed the Assistant Surgeon General of the Army that he did give her a commission in an Ohio regiment. She made her own uniform with, shockingly, a pair of bloomers under a shortened skirt. And went down to North Georgia, where not only was she treating civilians across Confederate lines, she was also conducting some espionage missions for the Union Army in the process. She was captured by Confederate forces and taken to the infamous Libby Prison in Richmond, Virginia, and eventually was traded for a male Confederate surgeon in a prisoner of war exchange. However, the conditions at Libby were so bad that she suffered from malnutrition and from eye damage because of the gaslighting in the prison, and she was never able to perform surgery again. She was awarded the Medal of Honor, which at the time had different criteria for being awarded than it does now. 2 years before her death, Congress rescinded about 900 of those Medals of Honor, including hers. She refused to give it back and wore it until she died. Nobody allowed Mary Edwards Walker to do anything. And women also fought from within for the right to serve at their fullest capacity. They were turned away from volunteering for different sorts of jobs. And in 1946, even though there had been a Women's Army Corps, there was discussion about making it regular, making it a reserve component, and some folks in the Department of the Navy decided that they only wanted women to be reserves, subject to indefinite recall. If there are any reservists in the room, I'm sure that you know how wonderful that would be. A senator, a Republican from Maine, Margaret Chase Smith, decided that wasn't good enough, and she amended the bill to make a full regular women's component of the Navy. Carl Vinson, a representative Republican from Georgia, re-amended the bill to make it reserves only and put it on the consent calendar, implying that it had been unanimously approved. And Smith got word of that. She objected to it. She forced it out onto the floor of the House for a full debate. And I'd like to just share a little bit of her testimony. This was from Tuesday, April 6, 1948. In the first place, I would call the attention of the House to page 48 of the consent calendar, wherein it describes Senate 1641 as, quote, an act to establish the Women's Army Corps in the regular Navy and Marine Corps, and the Naval and Marine Corps Reserve, and for other purposes. The members of the House will note that the words regular Army and regular Navy are predominant in the description of the bill. This is grossly misleading, as this bill, in the form it was reported out by the Committee on Armed Services, in no respect establishes the Women's Corps in either the regular Army or the regular Navy. Make no mistake about it, it's a temporary, one-year reserve bill. The Senate voted to give women regular status as well as reserve status in passing Senate 1641, but the House Armed Services Committee refused to give regular status. The House bill definitely dodges the issue. The issue is simple. Either the armed services have a permanent need of women officers and enlisted women, or they do not. If they do, then the women must be given a permanent status. The only possible permanent status is that of regular status. The Senate granted the request of the armed services to give women regular as well as reserve status in the armed services and rejected the attempts to deny women regular status. This legislation does not give women any security in their military service because it discriminates against women, and it will result only in not getting women of desirable caliber for the armed services. I am convinced that this is extremely unwise legislation. When there's such a radical difference between the Senate version and the House version, it's extremely surprising that an attempt would be made to get this legislation railroaded through on the consent calendar. So, in the meantime, while the debate was continuing, Smith found out that some legislative liaisons were meeting in closed executive session with the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee and with Congressman Vinson, and they were going to amend the bill yet again. And she finally went over their heads so hard and so fast that she left boot tracks on their scalps. She went straight to the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, and basically wrote him a letter and said, who do we believe? Who has integrity here? Is it the people making the official statements on the floor saying that there will be a full women's regular component, or is it the people talking in the back rooms? Forrestal immediately sent letters to the House and the Senate supporting the establishment of a regular women's component, and Harry Truman signed the Women's Armed Services Act in June of 1948, making women a permanent part of the regular Army from then on.
When we were first talking about pulling this book together, it seemed obvious at first that, of course, we would divide the stories into the various sections of wars and conflicts. So, of course, there's the section for the Revolutionary War and stories from those women who actually cross-dressed as men for the opportunity to serve. Then came the Civil War, in which we had women who served as spies on both sides. And their stories are harrowing in the book. You talk about some gutsy women. Woo! Wait till you read those stories. Oh my goodness! Go ahead. Did you
one actually tried to burn down the Confederate White House on her way out of Richmond.
Yeah. So there were some really, really gutsy women there. And of course, the Harriet Tubman story that Jerry's already read. And then we've got a section on the Spanish-American War. Of course, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam War, and then it goes into Desert Storm, and then, of course, the current wars that we're in the middle of at this moment. But we realized that something was still missing. Even with all of those sections covered with stories, we were still missing a really important part. We knew that we needed to add an entire chapter about the Cold War, for example. And we have some fascinating stories in there for you to read about women who served during the Cold War. And then we also knew that there was another piece we were missing, which was about the gender wars. So we decided that we would have one separate chapter just for that. And I'd like to share part of one of those excerpts with you at this point. And I am on page 229. For those of you who would like to follow along. I'm going to read a little section by Victoria Hudson, but let me tell you a little bit first about Victoria. Victoria Hudson, the author of No Red Pen, Writers, Writing Groups, and Critique, earned her Master of Fine Arts degree from St. Mary's College of California in 2008. Her poetry and essays have been published in a variety of online and print literary journals and anthologies, and she sponsors an annual registration scholarship for one writer to attend the San Francisco Writers Conference. She's an urban farmer, voracious reader and photographer. She coaches women's and youth rugby and is a mom and wife. In 2012, she retired after 33 years' service. This section by Victoria is titled My Army Wife. In a way, 9/11 helped solidify my relationship. When the towers went down, Monica and I had been dating about 9 months, and the U-Haul hadn't been pulled up to the door yet. I was packing and checking my field gear, getting ready to mobilize right after the attacks, when we had a discussion about being gay in the military and what that might mean for us. I pretty much said, if you can't do this, break up with me now. And no, we can't be friends if we do. 3 years later, we got married. We had a year engagement and then a wedding at Central Reform Congregation in St. Louis, Missouri, where I'd been stationed on my second recall to active duty after 9/11. 2 weeks before our wedding, Mayor Gavin Newsom of San Francisco decided to allow same-sex marriages, and the night before Valentine's Day in 2004, I asked Monica if she wanted to get married the next day. Surprised is not the word. Given my military status, getting married to someone of the same gender was a specific prohibition in military regulations. 2 weeks later, we had our religious ceremony. I wore a civilian suit with my military medals on the lapel and cut the cake with my officer's sword. We spoke at the reception about how the very act of wedding, both of them, were acts of civil disobedience and grounds for my discharge from the service. I'll skip ahead, down to the bottom. When our daughter was born, a new issue with the military came up: how to register her as a dependent without outing myself at the same time. I had to register her before she turned a year old. We spent the year trying to find the best way. If I adopted her, Monica would be required to renounce her parental rights. That certainly defeated the point of our third marriage and first legal one intended to secure parental rights. We tried to do a special adoption where Monica would not have to give up her rights, but no judge would assist with that process. In either course, a new birth certificate would have been issued without Monica listed as the mother. This would certainly have protected me from the military, but how could I deny our daughter her own biological mother? I'm skipping ahead. Monica was also listed as friend on the DD-93 emergency data form. The DD-93 is the document that provides direction when a service member is killed or wounded in service. Because I declined to list any related kin and had no spouse, I was required to receive counseling regarding my unusual choice of beneficiary for my death. I found this particularly insulting and offensive given the 10 years we'd been together. Monica, like every other military spouse, like every other Army wife, steadfastly supported me while I deployed to war and otherwise served the nation. She took over and cared for all aspects of my life while I was gone, paid my bills, fed and cared for my pets, took care of our home, raised our child while I was gone on duty, was the support that enabled me to serve without worry about the home front. And she did it all alone. No family support group, no phone calls to check in and see if she needed anything, no lifeline of unofficial information via the family readiness group, Grapevine, no one to talk with about her fears and worries when she didn't hear from me for a few days or longer while I was in a war zone. All alone. The DD-93 is the form that tells the service who to notify. I was not allowed to list my spouse on that form as a spouse, which would ensure that she would receive the respect, courtesy, and dignity of a family notification. I volunteered for the service. She just volunteered to love me.
So the other story that we had been told from the beginning of our time in the service was that women's increased roles were a social experiment pushed on the armed forces by feminazis. Yeah. It wasn't feminazis pushing anything on anybody. Margaret Chase Smith put her money where her mouth was. She joined the Air Force. She was commissioned directly as a lieutenant colonel and served concurrently for 8 years while she was a sitting senator. People like Vicki Hudson, were hiding in plain sight and just doing their jobs as well as they could. Those were the women who pushed open the doors just by doing a good job. We're not a social experiment. We were soldiers. We were sailors. And we ended up in Iraq and Afghanistan doing the same jobs, in many cases, as the men, and coming home to a country that did not recognize many of us as veterans, but with the same physical and moral injuries as the men.
And oftentimes, until really of late, if even, women in Iraq and Afghanistan were not even equipped with the proper fitting uniforms. So you know, that was also a major issue for them. I'm going to skip us ahead to page 309 for anyone who's following, because I'm going to tell you a little bit about Brooke King. Brooke King was born in 1985, and she was in the U.S. Army. Oh, I need my glasses. Brooke King from Tampa, Florida, deployed to Iraq in 2006 and served as a wheeled vehicle mechanic, a machine gunner, and recovery specialist. Do you know what a recovery specialist is? Anybody? Yes, ma'am. I'm afraid if you didn't hear, a recovery specialist is someone who goes out with a team to recover those who, say, from an IED explosion, and they're there to pick up bodies and the parts. So she was part of that team. She was the wife of a fellow veteran and mother to twin boys who were conceived in Iraq. Who says there's no sex in a war zone? Okay. King began writing about her unique experiences as a way to cope with PTSD. This piece is called Redeployment Packing Checklist. Pack your Army combat uniforms first. Military roll. Cram the black Under Armour sports bras, the tan undershirts, and the Lucky Convoy socks around the bottom inside edges of your green Army-issued duffel bag. Tuck the laminated photo into the bag, but don't look at it. You don't want to look at it. It's the picture that you held after your first recovery mission in the sandbox, where you bagged and tagged three soldiers who had burned alive after their striker rolled over a pressure plate IED. Your brother's smirk and your father's wide grin, your look of disenchantment, the picture taken when you were on R&R, all three of you standing in front of the house, each one of you pretending that nothing had changed since you left for Iraq. It helped you fall asleep. It helped you fall asleep that night. You can't help yourself. You unpack the photo to look at it once more. The corner edges are falling apart. The girl in the photo used to be you, but that's not the face you see in the mirror anymore. Pack your camo-covered Army Bible. The pages have to be rubber-banded shut, otherwise it opens to Psalm 23. Pack your tan, right in the rain, combat notebook, another sort of Bible. The name and rank of every soldier you ever placed into a black body bag written on its pages. Letters to your father that you never mailed. Pack the maroon prayer rug you stole while raiding a house in Sadr City. Unpack the prayer rug. Kneel on it while you pack the empty M4 magazines, the pistol holster, ammo pouches, and desert combat boots. Pick up your aviator gloves, the feel of manning the 50 cal machine gun. Pick up the shell casing from your first confirmed kill, one of six 7.62 caliber bullets that you fired into a 15-year-old's chest. He was shooting an AK-47 at you. You shouldn't have the shell casings. You shouldn't have the gloves. Women weren't supposed to see combat. Pack it all into the duffel. Pack the hours spent in a cement bunker waiting for mortar rounds to stop whistling into base. Pack the hate and the anger. Pack the fear. Pack the shame and disenchantment for a job done too well. Pack the back-to-back months spent going out on convoy without a day off. Pack your combat lifesaver bag, your Haji killing license, and the rest of your dignity. pack them all next to the Army core values and the bullshit promise your government made to protect innocent civilians. Pack your worn copy of Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. Pack the tattered American flag you picked up off the ground outside Abu Ghraib. Fold over the top flaps. Shut it up tight. Lock it. Heave it onto your back. Carry it all home.
And now we'd like to invite questions from the audience so that everybody can hear. There is a microphone right over here by the front row. So if you have questions or comments, please just come on up to the mic.
We're not that good. Surely there are questions.
I have one question, and that is, when did Margaret Chase Smith join the military? Do you know?
I believe it was late 19, maybe 1949, 1950, that time frame. She is better known, by the way, for her Declaration of Conscience. In addition to joining the Air Force, she was also the first person to challenge Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Committees. Her speech, Declaration of Conscience, is something that everybody needs to read.
I'd like to know from each of you, what stories did you grapple with the most, that had the deepest impact on you, that you struggled with the most?
I think for me, there were two stories that really were hard for me to read. One of them is a narrative of one of the 77 Army, and I believe there were also some Navy nurses who were interned for 3 years in San Tomas prison camp in Manila during World War II by the Japanese. And when I was reading those stories, it made me furious that nobody, in naval history class, nobody in my chain of command ever thought to tell me that women had been prisoners of war, not just in World War II, but all the way back to the American Revolution when Margaret Corbin's gun position was overrun at the Battle of Fort Washington and the British captured her. I didn't know. And the other story that was very hard for me to read was Linda Van Devanter's memoir, Home Before Morning. Linda Van Devanter was an Army nurse in Vietnam, and because as a small child I watched a lot of footage of what was going on in Vietnam, I had a cousin who was stationed in the Philippines and we were terrified he would be sent in country. Those stories were very hard and felt very real to me because I felt like I knew some of those people.
And I would concur with everything that Jerry has said here, too. One of the things that we would do, because I had never worked with another author before. I had always worked solo. So part of the challenge was, how do we share things? How do we go back and forth? And one day I happened to look back at our Facebook messaging track. And if we were to print that out, I bet it would be over 500 pages of messages, because she would write, "Do you know what I just found? You're not going to believe this." And then I would go, "No, well, guess what I just read?" And then we would send each other emails that were marked ICOB in case of bus. So in case one of us was ever struck by that proverbial bus, then the other would have the rest of the story and the mission could carry on. So we were exchanging these things all the time, and I used to joke with Jerry, who is the mother of two beautiful teenage boys and wife of a handsome, adorable husband who is here, who I'm meeting for the first time. And I used to say, you know what? You're going to need therapy after this book, because you're in a house with three men and we're reading all of these stories about these women who've just, to a large degree, been so diminished and really discounted. And it's painful to read that. And I was lucky because my husband was a coach in baseball. He was gone for 9 months. So he wasn't even in the house when I had to go through all this. But Jerry had to go through this experience with three men in the house.
Dave, Will, and John out there at scout camp, I'm sorry.
But maybe you understand a little bit now, Dave. No, she was always talking about how supportive you are. One, the Cornelia Fort story. Does that not touch your heart? Oh, that one really hit me hard. I mean, that one really hit me hard. And then from everything that we were able to ascertain from this, that young man, that young pilot's career was, he was pretty much saved. He was really trying to show off, probably trying to get her attention, and it ended up killing her. And it was just very heartbreaking to read. That one really, really hurt. And I think one of the reasons why Linda Vandevanter's memoir, Home Before Morning, about Vietnam really touched me was because she was incredibly brave to write that memoir. Incredibly brave at the time when she did. In fact, I believe she's probably, one of the first women to ever really tell the story about women suffering post-traumatic stress? And when the book came out, she was so vilified for having shared her story and about what really happened in a war zone over there. And she was a nurse. And everything that she saw, and everything she experienced, and it was so heartbreaking to realize, and she ended up dying very young from, what was it? Was it lupus or MS? Or
I think it was some sort of autoimmune disorder, right, that was not otherwise identified.
Exactly. And it just really touched me that she had been so brave in sharing her story. And she was really, in a sense, ahead of her time for doing so. And ended up very vilified as a result. So that story really got to me as well. Thanks for the question. Any others? Yes, ma'am.
It sounds like with all the research you did that there's going to have to be a second book coming out. But I was wondering, too, as you're saying, the women being able to tell their stories and for you all to put it out, which I'm very happy to get one of your books to read it. But like some of the more current women, I'm assuming that you've talked to them and met them. And is this like they've been waiting for this chance a little bit too? Are things sort of getting better where they feel like, you see what I'm trying to say there too? And so the more recent women and their stories, do you feel like this outlet was something that is still so needed and will continue to be, or do you see a bright future at all?
One of the questions that often comes up at writers' conferences when we get the group of what we call war writers together is, why aren't the women veterans writing fiction? There's been some short published fiction, and no woman veteran out of the conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan has published a critically acclaimed novel yet. There have been some that they've been very short-lived. And I honestly think that one of the reasons that that's happening is because that ground truth, that memoir, making people believe that, yes, there really were women there, is necessary before we can start writing our fiction, before we can start going beyond, yes, damn it, I was there, I did the job, to turning it into art. The second book that I would love to see, a similar history for African American women and other women of color. We felt that we couldn't do justice to that, and that story it deserves to be told as its own separate story by a person of color who feels it in ways that Tracy and I simply can't. But I think there's more to come.
One of the exciting things for women right now and for a lot of our veterans returning is the GI Bill. And because of the GI Bill, we do see a lot of young men and women returning and going into writing programs. Because what we've discovered, and we actually teach writing, both of us, in different places, but what we've discovered is that writing, like a lot of the arts, is really a pathway toward a level of healing. And so veterans are finding that telling their story, whether they're doing it for self-reflection or a family legacy, or whether they hope to someday publish it, they're finding the writing is actually very helpful in helping them control the memory. So what I believe we're probably going to see, to answer your question a little bit more specifically, is we're seeing a lot of these young men and women coming out of these writing programs now at universities. And one of those is Brooke King, the woman veteran's story, the last one I just read. Wasn't that mesmerizing? Yeah, I mean, it's right into the gut, right in the solar plexus. And Brooke is a product of the GI Bill, one of the writing programs at a university in the country, and now actually teaches creative writing herself at St. Leo College down in Florida. So I believe that we will start to see more and more of these. And I believe this book, along with others and other memoirs that are out there now, will actually encourage more and more women to come forth with their stories. We were disappointed that we couldn't find very many Coast Guard stories. So we need more African American stories. We need more Coasties to write their stories. If we have any Coasties here, oh my goodness, we have one. Ding, 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 ding. Young lady, we want your story. Yes, that's what I do. I teach writing. So does Jerry. Yes, we will help you write your story.
And I would just add, I forgot to mention this earlier, that this book also would not have been possible without the Veterans Writing Project staff and their support for me while I was writing, speaking of writing programs and encouraging people to tell their stories and to take control of the story before the story controls you. If Ron Capps, the director, had not challenged me to create a writing course that was tailored specifically for women because women weren't speaking up, then I never would have gone looking for women's stories.
Yes.
The question I have is, I'd like to know how many people in here are veterans, men or women.
Could we have a show of hands? How many veterans do we have? Oh, I love it. Wonderful. Yes. Thank you. What branch, ma'am?
I was in the Air Force in the days when if you got pregnant, they said goodbye.
Right. Yes.
I was in the medical corps, and those people suffered too because they didn't treat us like the military. We were military officers, but they didn't treat us like that.
Well, and pregnancy was in the testimony, the congressional testimony that Margaret Chase Smith was dealing with, pregnancy and the infirmities of menopause, God help us all, were used as reasons that it would be too expensive to have a women's component in the Army. Does that sound familiar to anybody this week? Yeah, it was nonsense then. It's nonsense now. Whether it applies to women or whether it applies to our comrades in arms who are transgender.
Mary Walker,
who very well may have been. And one of my personal favorites, Alfred Cashier, born Jenny Hodgers in Ireland. Alfred Cashier lived 50 years after his service in the Civil War. As a man, his comrades from his regiment kept his secret. Some of them did know that he was biologically female. They encouraged him to live as a man. When in a nursing home, he was forced into women's clothes. His health deteriorated rapidly, which also shouldn't surprise anybody. And he only lived a couple more years after that. He was buried as Alfred Cashier, a man with full military honors.
We thank you so much for coming out tonight and taking this trip through Herstory with us. Thank you so much. And if you've got any other questions, we'll be happy to take them up here up front. Okay? Thank you all.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.